Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines. I'm Janine Jackson. This week on Counterspin, corporate media cover electoral politics a lot. Yet the questions that guide that coverage don't seem to change much. Who's leading in polls before anyone's learned much about the candidate's ideas? Who said what awful thing about their opponent? Who's raised more money from rich people? That's not the same as covering the electoral process. Do elections represent the public will? Does everyone who wants to vote get to? How can we ensure that our voting process reflects the principles of democracy that are so insistently invoked? There are a few questions more critical right now. We'll talk about them with John Powers, counsel in the Voting Rights Project at the Lawyers Committee for Civil Rights Under Law. Also on the show, when you think school safety, you may think about the Parkland shooting, or Sandy Hook, or Columbine. Certainly that would be the media context in which the phrase occurs. But policies and practices based on that definition of safety end up making kids, particularly kids who are Black and brown, or LGBTQ, or disabled, less protected and less secure in school. A new report from the Institute for Policy Studies, Students Under Siege, outlines how that happens and how alternative definitions of safety lead to better outcomes for kids, their families, and schools. We'll speak to the report's co-author, Karen Dolan. She's director of the Criminalization of Race and Poverty Project at the Institute for Policy Studies. All of that's coming up, and I think we'll get right to it. You're listening to Counterspin, brought to you each week by the Media Watch Group FAIR. So many reporters swarmed into the tiny town of Cuthbert, Georgia. A county attorney told Rolling Stone's Jamil Smith it filled up the Econo Lodge. The subject of the media scrum, which it should be noted followed community outcry, was a political consultant's plan to shut down 7 of 9 polling places in an overwhelmingly Black and low-income county on the pretense that they were inaccessible to people with disabilities, a concern he appears only to have developed after Stacey Abrams, a Black woman, was nominated for governor. The Board of Elections of Randolph County voted down the outrageous proposal, but for many, the ham-fisted maneuver stands as a warning of how far and how low some will go in trying to suppress the votes of the Black, brown, and poor. With critical elections on the horizon, there's never been greater need for scrutiny of the voting process in this country and the efforts to disconnect it from anything like real democracy. John Powers is counsel in the Voting Rights Project at the Lawyers Committee for Civil Rights Under Law. He joins us now by phone from Atlanta. Welcome to Counterspin, John Powers.
Thank you for having me on.
Well, the Georgia shenanigans have their particulars. It wasn't an official who tried it, but this consultant that the county brought in and has since fired. And the Board of Elections voted it down following normal procedures. It was never a done deal. But I have to believe that the outcry and the spotlight were salutary, even if it overwhelmed this little town, for exposing voter suppression, which can take many different forms, can't it? It's not just as simple always as shutting down polling places.
That's right. The voting process is, in the United States, a lengthy one, of course. You have to register. You have to figure out which voting precinct and polling place you're in, assuming that your registration application is actually approved by the Board of Elections. Then you have to decide to vote either by absentee ballot or early voting in person at a location or on election day. And the sad truth is that there are jurisdictions around the country that have made it more difficult for people to vote at each and every stage of that process.
Well, I want to draw you out on one particular aspect of this. So someone who hasn't voted in a while because they haven't been moved to or because their situation meant that they couldn't, but now they want to vote and they find they've been erased from the rolls. Can you explain purges?
One thing that a lot of voters aren't aware of with respect to their registration status is that it's not necessarily permanent. If someone voted, say, for former President Obama in 2008 or 2012 and haven't voted since then, they may no longer be on the list, even if they haven't moved from their house since then. The Supreme Court decided in the Ohio case, Husted, that a voter can be placed in an inactive status and then ultimately removed just for not having voted in the past number of election cycles. So voters have to remain vigilant to make sure that they are on the list and may have to take additional steps, even though they haven't done anything to take themselves off the list if they haven't voted in a while.
Well, it seems anti-democratic on its face. You know, you haven't voted, so you can't. But I understand these purges are also flawed in practice.
There's a lot of problems with how these systems are set up. For example, if a Board of Elections can flag someone to be purged, if mail sent to them is returned as undeliverable by the Postal Service, or if the Board of Elections receives other information indicating that the voter may have moved, even though that's not actually true, the Board of Elections will then send you a little postcard that looks like a piece of junk mail. If you don't fill that piece of mail out and return it, the Board of Elections takes that as you admitting that you no longer reside at that jurisdiction, and then you can be removed within a couple of election cycles. And most people don't realize that notice means that, and therefore they don't fill it out, which is why so many folks get removed improperly on the basis that they move.
I understand that these purges are increasing lately. I think there's new research from Brennan that suggests that. Can you explain briefly what things like this have to do with Shelby County versus Holder, the 2013 Supreme Court decision? A lot of this is connected in one way or another with that ruling, isn't it?
It is. In 2013, the Supreme Court rendered an extremely important opinion in Shelby County v. Holder, which lifted many jurisdictions across the country from having to submit changes to their voting practices and procedures for what was called preclearance or review by the Department of Justice. And that preclearance process forced jurisdictions to be really careful about the voting changes they enacted and submitted for review because they were prohibited from adopting changes that either had a discriminatory effect on minority voters or was adopted for the purpose of making it more difficult for minority voters to cast a ballot. And what we've seen since the Shelby County versus Holder decision is that jurisdictions no longer being monitored and having to submit things for review have said, okay, now we're free, we can do whatever we want. And that places an extreme burden on local voters and nonprofits to challenge things at the local level and, if necessary, bring lawsuits, so meaning that things that before could have easily been stopped in its tracks by DOJ at the outset now get through, and it requires, for example, in Georgia, there are 159 counties. It's hard for community activists to stay engaged and fight in every single county in a state, you know, let alone the entire country.
And I would just point out, states weren't chosen randomly to have to pre-clear their election laws. They were particularly those places that had a history of racial discrimination, right?
That's exactly right. The states subject to Section 5 pre-clearance had been chosen for that specifically because they had a track record of discrimination leading to the passage of the Voting Rights Act of 1965 in the first place. And what we've seen is that since Shelby County, it is these states where we've seen the number of problematic voting changes increase rapidly in recent years. You could go through a laundry list of voting precinct consolidations, purges of voters, enacting very draconian exact match registration requirements where people get booted off the rolls for having a hyphen in their voter registration application but not on their driver's license, as well as proof of citizenship requirements. There's a number of different barriers that have been erected that make it more difficult for minority voters to have an equal say in the political process.
Well, let me read you a quote. The New York Times, in reporting on the Supreme Court's upholding of the Ohio Republicans' plans on purging, the Times called it, quote, a vivid reminder that measures placing obstacles between people seeking to vote and their ability to cast ballots, including cutbacks on early voting, elimination of same-day registration, and tough voter ID laws, present dueling visions of democracy. Republicans have pushed for such restrictions, arguing without evidence that they are needed to combat what they say is widespread voter fraud. Democrats have pushed back, countering that the efforts are part of an attempt to suppress voting by Democratic constituencies, particularly minorities, close quote. Corporate media have been, I think, increasingly willing to say, as the Times does here, that claims of voter fraud are unsubstantiated. But to present the idea that they represent voter suppression as a counter to that, as if it were equally groundless and partisan, you know, to call them dueling visions, I think is journalistic malpractice, frankly. What are your thoughts, finally, on what responsible reporting on voting, on these important voting issues, would include? What would you like to see from media?
That's a very good question. You're absolutely correct that the media has played a game of false equivalence when it comes to reporting on the battle for voting rights in America. The simple fact is that jurisdictions that have wanted to disenfranchise voters have been raising the specter of voter fraud for more than 100 years now. Tools like the literacy tests, grandfather clauses, poll taxes were justified on the grounds of protecting the integrity of the ballot box and preventing voter fraud. And these rationales are just as specious now as they were back then. There's been exhaustive studies in Texas and Georgia and North Carolina where government officials have spent large number of taxpayer dollars hunting for voter fraud, and they simply can't find it. You either see no criminal charges or convictions whatsoever, or the criminalization of innocent behavior in which poor voters who are not aware of the significance of their actions end up getting prosecuted for making innocent mistakes. So that's what you have on one side of the ledger. On the other side, you see the enactment of legislation and pursuing practices, whether it's strict voter ID, proof of citizenship requirements, exact match voter registration verification procedures, the use of cross-check between the various states, reducing the number of early voting locations and election day polling locations. A whole panoply of practices that have had tangible, measurable effects in terms of reducing the number of people who have been able to participate in the political process. And, of course, creating these burdens has the most significant impact on our country's most vulnerable citizens, who happen to generally be those from a lower socioeconomic status and education level and income level, and who have greater burdens in their lives that make it more difficult to jump through the extra hoops that have been placed in front of them. And to say that the thousands of voters who have been disenfranchised, or when it comes to gerrymandering and redistricting, whose actual votes mean less because they've been placed into cracked or passed districts, to put that on an equal footing with so-called ballot integrity and preventing voter fraud is a grievous mistake. And hopefully going forward, the media will look at the hard science and the data and be more willing to call out attempts at voter suppression for what they really are.
We've been speaking with John Powers, counsel in the Voting Rights Project at the Lawyers Committee for Civil Rights Under Law. You can find their work online at lawyerscommittee.org. John Powers, thank you so much for joining us this week on Counterspin.
Thank you for having me.
Nothing says America 2018 like a spate of stories on how back-to-school shopping includes bulletproof backpacks. Arming teachers and gearing kids up like commandos are presented as more or less reasonable responses to concerns about school safety. Any violence in schools is too much, of course, but a conversation about school safety that's focused on guns and bullets is a narrow and distorted conversation. Recasting our definition of a safe school environment could lead us in some very different directions. Karen Dolan is director of the Criminalization of Race and Poverty Project at the Institute for Policy Studies and co-author with Ebony Slaughter Johnson and Mayaka Sampson of the recent report, Students Under Siege: How the School-to-Prison Pipeline, Poverty, and Racism Endanger Our School Children. She joins us now by phone from Washington, D.C. Welcome to Counterspin, Karen Dolan.
Thank you, Janine. It's a pleasure.
Well, take us through what you see as the most salient observations in this report. What were you looking at, and what did you find?
Well, we were looking at the ways in which children can have the most support and the best chance at the best life. And while we are doing this work and this research, the Parkland shooting happened, of course, and it has been in the news a lot, gun violence and school shootings, which, of course, endanger our public school students. But at the same time, there's a larger number of students, there's millions of students who are also being endangered simply by having their future cut short by excessive expulsions, suspensions, referrals to the criminal justice system, lack of proper supports in school for academics, for social and emotional learning, and for well-being. And as we hear the discussions on the airways, as we read it in the newspaper, as you said about going back to school and the education department suggesting that we take money away from student supports and put them into arming teachers and putting more cops in the hallways, it's really exactly the wrong thing that we should be doing. And what we would like to do is to see the debate broaden into looking at safety measures in a deeper, more holistic way as our students return to school.
Well, when you say it's the wrong thing to do or the wrong direction, that has to do with the impacts of these punitive, get-tough school policies that people often say are aimed at safety, but the fallout from them falls out in certain kinds of ways.
Well, that's right. So the impacts can be very devastating and very long term. So you see everything from a child having one suspension doubling their chances of dropping out of high school, which will affect them for the rest of their lives, to schools that have these school resource officers who are indeed law enforcement officers armed, that these schools that have the presence of school resource officers have about a 5-time greater instance of referring children to the juvenile legal system. So these are very deep and lasting impacts on children for the rest of their lives, not to mention on their families and their communities at the time that it happens and on the schools themselves.
Well, obviously, the reason for the concern, the heart of it, is, as you say, the impact on the lives and the education of kids. But I want to underscore that this report is about facts and not feelings. You know, it draws on statistical data to tell a story of what's going on and the way these things actually affect folks.
That's right. So all of the evidence really points to the ways in which students are harmed this way, and their earning power and their graduation from school are negatively impacted. And we find that the children who are most affected are children that are from poor and low-income families, children with disabilities, Black children, immigrant children, Latinx children, LGBTQ children. So children who already have had a historic marginalization in one way or another are feeling the impact even greater in schools that employ these kinds of tactics and these kinds of punishment that further put obstacles in their path of being able to have a safe childhood and thrive as an adult.
Well, nobody says, you know, we think Black and brown, and especially poor Black and brown kids, should just get used to being policed, you know, being treated as potential criminals, because that's how we view them. You know, that's not what they say. The claims are about safety and security, presumably as these relate positively to education. So it should matter if you can show that these practices do not, in fact, increase safety. You know, that should have an impact. And for those who are not ideologically committed to punitive discipline, there are alternatives. And I just wanted to ask, you know, what does the report have to say about other approaches to school safety?
That's right. So there are alternatives that have been proven to be effective, whereas these other punitive discipline and zero tolerance policies have proven to be detrimental and destructive to children, not just the children who are being disciplined, but the whole community and the whole school. Mm-hmm. So on the other side, schools that undertake restorative justice practices, restorative practices in their classrooms or as a whole school, schools that are using social and emotional and academic development within their curriculum, where they're looking at the whole child, they're looking at the circumstances in a child's community or a child's family. They're involving family, involving community. They're involving the children in the way that they are, that they can best learn and best be supported. And looking at discipline rather than retributive or punitive, looking at it as a harm has happened. How do we restore that harm? How do we make our community whole again? It still includes accountability. But what it does is it involves all of the stakeholders in the harm that has been done, and this has been shown to vastly reduce recidivism and to increase the satisfaction on the part of the person to whom harm has been done, and accountability on the part of the student who has done harm. So when you look at these holistically all together and you look at the results, that they have a much more positive results, you know, from A to Z, it's almost impossible to see how anybody would disregard using these practices that are proven to be positive versus the punitive zero tolerance discipline, which has proven to be detrimental.
Well, this is a little bit outside the report, but I wonder if I could ask if you think Betsy DeVos, as Secretary of Education, has she behaved in sort of the way you'd anticipated with regard to this set of issues? And what do you think the impact of her tenure might be, or the direction that she's sort of pushing things from the top down as Secretary of Education?
Well, I think she's been an unmitigated failure with regard to protecting students. I have sat down with her face-to-face around some of the LGBTQ issues, and her department has rescinded most of the protections and guidances that have been put in place to address some of these issues that we know are issues. So the Education Department has declined to exercise oversight and has made it clear that they won't intervene when there are problems with discrimination and overly harsh punitive processes, and now have proposed to take funding from these very supports for children and put them instead into purchasing guns for teachers who don't want them.
Well, it really, even when things don't become law, they send a clear signal all the way down, don't they, that folks respond to?
That's right. There's almost no recourse at the federal government right now.
Well, let me ask you what you see as media's role here. Certainly, sensationalist coverage of what school shootings do occur is not helpful. But in terms of the broader set of issues, are there things you'd like to see journalists digging into? Is there anything you'd like to see more of or less of on the part of media?
Yes, I'd certainly like to see them cover more things like what we're talking about in this report. Cover more the positive results from social and emotional learning from restorative justice. It's happening in communities all across the country. You know, really talk about this when you're talking about safety. Don't just talk about the physical aspect of what is still relatively rare occurrence or mass shootings in schools, but really what's happening on a broad scale around the country, what really endangers children in their day-to-day lives at school. I think that the media would do very well to take a look at that and really report the facts of what's happening.
And maybe step outside of casting it as some sort of partisan issue. You know, right wing thinks this, other left wing thinks that. And, you know, if you put kids and actual facts at the center of the conversation, it probably would change it.
Well, that's right. I don't think that anybody deep down feels that the safety of our children is a partisan issue. It's a matter of understanding what the word safety means in a holistic way for the well-being of our children and their future.
We've been speaking with Karen Dolan, director of the Criminalization of Race and Poverty Project at the Institute for Policy Studies. You can find the report, Students Under Siege, on their website, ips-dc.org. Karen Dolan, thank you very much for joining us this week on Counterspin.
It's my pleasure. Thank you.
And that's it for Counterspin for this week. Counterspin is produced by FAIR, the National Media Watch Group based in New York. If you missed part of today's show or you'd like to hear previous shows, you can find them on FAIR's website, FAIR.org. The show's engineered by Erica Rosato. I'm Janine Jackson. Thanks for listening to Counterspin.